Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Is it really a dog? That's what we want to know. Is it really a dog? Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. And before we go any further, I want to thank everyone who pledged in support of Talking Animals, WMNF, and me in the station's Winter Fun Drive, which concluded Monday when we collectively made our goal. Yay! This drive was an uphill battle, most notably perhaps when our phone system crashed, but we're all the more jubilant about this triumph, which was truly a group effort, a community effort. So again, thank you very, very much for your support. Onward! My guest today is animal advocate and artist Jane O'Hara, who paints pieces that depict the plight of various animals by juxtaposing realistic animal portraits against what she calls vaguely surreal elements, aiming to challenge viewers to see the animals in a different light. She's also curated Beasts of Burden, an exhibition that's shown so far in New York and Boston of O'Hara and 14 fellow artists who use animals as their subject for an array of reasons, examining the often complicated connections we have with animals, their relations, how intertwined they are with our lives, and so on. We'll hear about her feelings about animals, how that shaped her artwork, the genesis of Beasts of Burden, and more when I speak with Jane O'Hara in a moment here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak with Rowan Deacon, director of Nature, The Last Rhino, a new PBS documentary airing tonight about Sudan, the very last male northern white rhinoceros. Also, a friend of mine and a friend of the show, and a sometime guest host of this show, just said farewell to his beloved dog, so I want to be sure to say my condolences, Ronnie, and rest in peace, sweet Jamaica. Right now, let's get to Jane with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Jane O'Hara on Talking Animals. Good morning, Jane.
Hi, Duncan. I'm so happy to be on here with you and your listeners. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals. So, lots to talk about today. For you, let's start here. Which came first, the passion for animals or the passion for art?
I would have to say, I guess, art, as far as passion being moving you into motion, and I went to art school and that sort of thing. But I've always loved animals.
Yeah, well, let's look at that, because given the nature of the show, I guess we have to sort of tilt our emphasis a little bit in the direction of the animals. Not entirely today, obviously, but since you have placed animals at the center of your work, it does suggest a considerable passion for them. So when would you say that passion began? I mean, what did animals, for example, mean to you as a kid?
Well, you know, I grew up with a dog, different dogs at different times, and loved them passionately, and I had a thing for pigs. I had a poster of a pig, but my experience growing up was very much limited to those, to my, as far as live animals go, my own pets. Like a lot of people, I was completely involved with the disconnection. I ate meat. I never thought about it. I could pat a, you know, an animal and not even make the connection.
And curious, in terms of the environment in which that took place, what role did animals play in your family growing up? I mean,
well,
it sounded like there was a dog, but I mean, were there other animals? Were there more than one at a time? I mean, what was the general sense of people's feelings about animals just in the household?
It was pretty limited. You know, we had a dog when I was very young named Cinders. And then after Cinders died, we got another dog named Sammy. And so there was really not much. I mean, we went to the zoo occasionally. I never liked zoo. We went to the circus occasionally. I never liked the circus. But I really did not have a lot of experience with farm animals or any other animals, really, except for what I just listed.
Okay, so let's come back around then to the other sort of crucial timeline here. When did you start creating art in a way that really was meaningful to you, and just where you said, hey, I'm not just doing art, but I really kind of consider myself an artist at this point?
Well, I went to art school. I went to Boston University School of Fine Arts. Then I took a large hiatus from painting. And when I got back to it with my now husband, we would go out painting. And I pretty quickly realized that I was kind of bored painting a landscape. So I started bringing photographs of animals and putting them into the painting. And so it's funny, but it's kind of like in reverse. The act of painting these animals that weren't even, you know, alive or I wasn't observing kind of began to sensitize me towards other animals as I really would get into trying to create the expression and imagine what they were feeling or thinking. And so that was sort of the first step. And I started, once they came into my paintings, they never left. But then years later, I went to the Byzantium exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. And I was looking at all these saints who had sacrificed their lives to God. And I started thinking about, what about animals? What powers have they sacrificed their lives? And I just, this idea for this painting, Sacrifice, which became a screen that I did in, I think it was 2005, just really sensitized me to animals and what, you know, how they sacrifice their lives. Of course, in their case, it's not a choice. So I wasn't vegan at that point, and I was starting to learn a lot about what goes on with animals. I had first read this book called Diet for a New America by John Robbins, and though I sobbed through the entire thing, it didn't seem to be enough to get me to take the step to become vegan. I just felt like it was an impossibility. So anyway, I just, that's sort of how, the act, like I said before, the act of painting the animals for this screen, Sacrifice, where the animals are wearing the vestments of the companies and universities and circus and whatnot that they had sacrificed their lives to. The act of painting these pictures, you know, based on a lot of reference that I was getting, really kind of was the next step towards my sensitizing and taking the next step.
Okay, well, for people out there who are on Facebook, on Monday I did post Sacrifice, and in a moment I'm going to ask you to kind of describe it a bit further. But let me just let folks know, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is animal advocate and artist Jane O'Hara, whose art explores animal issues and our relationships with animals. If you'd like to ask Jane a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Yeah, maybe you started to touch a little bit on what a sacrifice is and what it looks like. Maybe you could just describe it a bit more fully for folks listening who haven't seen it, didn't see the post I did, and just because that sounds like kind of a turning point piece for you.
Yeah, it definitely was. It's a screen. It's 5 foot tall, four panels, and I am using the inspiration of the icons and from the Byzantium exhibit and the medieval works. So it involves a lot of gold leaf, and each animal has a halo around their head, and they each have a solemn pose with one paw up or in some sort of position of reverence, and then the vestments of the companies and universities and whatnot that they sacrifice their lives. So that's, I think, the best description I can give.
Okay. We already have some callers who seem eager to get in on the conversation. Let's get them.
Oh, good.
Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Jane O'Hara.
Yes, sounds like a revolutionary way of getting people to see what animals go through in the human-dominated world, where they're almost always viewed as beasts of burden, recreational objects, food objects. I'd just like to ask you to comment on this. One thing is the movie Zootopia and Watership Down. I would love to see an artist like yourself and others make movies and short videos, because video is the way people seem to be reached these days, that put the world in the viewpoint of animals, especially native species, and shows the bulldozers coming at them, the hunters, all of the terrible things that we do to animals. There hasn't been a really great movie yet. I think Watership Down was the closest, to show what it's like for all these innocent little creatures who are in their own homes, and then we come and destroy them. And the second thing is, and I know this is a little political, maybe better for Rob's show, but I think we should see the parallels between hunters and others, factory farmers, rodeo people, circus people, going to weaker species like animals and killing them, torturing them. And what that crazy kid did in South Florida, going to a place where unarmed humans were and murdering them too. I think there's a continuum between animal abuse and human abuse, and that it comes all from the same bad place in the human heart. So I'd love to hear you talk about those things, and thanks for your art.
All right, well, thank you for your call, and Jane, feel free to respond to some or all of that as you are inclined.
Okay. Unfortunately, I haven't seen either of those movies that you mentioned, but they're on my list now.
Okay.
Anyway, I do think that there's a lot of very interesting and compelling movies and videos out there already, approaching it from many different angles. You know, you take something like Babe or I'm not quick on my feet, but there's a lot out there that I think really approach things in these different ways. And I just think that there's an audience for every type of approach. And while Watership Down might strike you, it might not strike someone else in the same way. But I'm very encouraged by what I feel is a growing audience and movement of this sort of artwork and movies and video. There was that, what was that new movie? Okja, I think it was called.
Yeah, the Netflix film. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen that either. But again, it's like, I just think there's a lot of different ways to approach it. I mean, one of the main themes of my artwork is that I want to kind of bring awareness just through the dichotomy of the different animals. A lot of the work I do has animals in very different situations. One might be a pampered pet. One might be in restraints for animal testing. And I put them all in bubbles, and they're just coursing through life in these very different experiences. And so I'm trying to show all these different ways in which animals so randomly live these hugely different experiences. And but I do it in a way that I like to invite people to sort of respond to it at the level that they're seeing it, you know. So I'm not personally into a more militant messaging. I'm interested in people just being provoked to think a bit more or consider things. And we haven't gotten into it yet, but the Beast of Burden exhibition that I curate is an amplified version of that same thing. I have all these different artists who use animals in all the different ways that they find relevant and interesting, and it ranges everything from how animals are integrated into our lives as, metaphorically, political stand-ins, psychologically, as well as, you know, commenting on what goes on with animals, as you say, in these animal rights-based ways, and you know, everything else, just celebrating their beauty or their force of nature.
Yeah, as you suggested, we will get into a Beast of Burden in some detail later on in the interview. But before we move on to some of the other things I was hoping to speak with you about, do you have any comment on our caller's observation about the connection between hunters, hunting, guns, etc., and what just happened in Parkland a week ago today?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, I think it's been documented that a lot of killers, those serial killers or murderers, abused animals as children. But
as apparently this guy did.
Yeah, the case with him too. So, yeah, I mean, I think the overall thing here is that people need to respect and see the importance of animals. So, obviously, animal abuse by a child or a person is terrible. It's horrible, and I'm not a hunter. I'm not into hunting. But then there's the whole behind the scenes factory farms and all that, some people can be very environmentally focused about how things go on with animal factory farms and whatnot, and yet be eating a bacon burger. You know, so there's a lot of hypocrisy, but I think it's based in, not wanting to know to some degree, but also just ignorance. just not knowing. And that's what I hope to kind of just get people to think in different ways too. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it sort of does. And I think circling back to your work and how you approach it, so how succinctly can you identify your guiding principle, let's say, or the mission propelling your art?
Let's see. Well, I do try to, with my artwork, I do try to really through the eyes or through the just the painting and the composition and subject matter, I try to really, you know, connect a viewer to the animal. And so I look at animals as these beings that can't communicate for themselves. So I try to communicate with their images through my art and in using various subject matter and composition, and like I was describing with the bubble series I've done, I try to make these parallels where people can see how animals have these parallel in time existences, but they're completely, completely different. And so I would just, in a nutshell, just say my hope is that my artwork would just get people thinking, and I also feel that I paint in a way that I feel it's kind of enticing because it's usually, I don't know, kind of a sunny kind of environment and pulls you in.
Right. Well, there's clearly a lot of humor in your pieces, which, and you've already noted that you're really not going for, as you say, a more militant approach. I think it sounds like the idea really is to pull people in, to have them hopefully be intrigued and enchanted and in some cases maybe entertained, but then to have that provoke some thought and consideration about the animals depicted and what other issues may be suggested.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's clearly that once you hit that turning point of seeing that piece and then creating the sacrifice, which you described for us a few moments ago, that your art changed, that animals changed in your art, even though they're already there, how you presented them and depicted them changed. So animals clearly changed your art in that way. How has your art changed you and the way you think about animals over time?
I would say that the act of painting for me is very emotional. And, you know, I may go into something in a very cerebral way, but the act of painting, what the idea is, really touches my soul. So I would say that, you know, after that turning point, I still will paint animals celebrating their beauty and humor and that sort of thing. And I've done commissioned portraits and that sort of thing. But I started doing artwork that also spoke to some of the things that I was learning about and observing that go on, these atrocities and whatnot. So the act of painting them really opened my heart more and more, the best way I can put it.
So would you say that your perspective and that sensibility is applied more broadly for you than just whatever blank canvas that you happen to be facing it on a given day?
Actually, don't understand that question. Could you try again?
The perspective that you've hopefully developed from the time that you created the first piece, Sacrifice, which sounded like was a turning point, that was in 2005, you said, so 12, 13 years ago. So I'm just wondering if in your life and your sensibilities and otherwise your perspective, that employing that in your artwork has also changed you in a broader sense than just when you're in your studio painting on a canvas.
Oh, yes. Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, as I was saying, the act of painting these animals in these situations and everything has really opened my heart. And some of the things that felt impossible, like becoming a vegan, you know, living with more consciousness, trying not to do anything that would contribute to the major businesses out there that exploit animals, I'd say all of that has grown more and more every year.
Okay, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is animal advocate and artist Jane O'Hare. We're discussing animals, art, animals in art, and more. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So, Jane, to what extent have you had occasion, after people have seen your work, to get a sense, conversationally, otherwise, comments online or whatever it might be, about how they were affected and perhaps changed by your artwork?
Some of it is negative. I feel like some people have drifted off because they don't really want to be thinking about stuff like that. I have felt like I've had some distance with some older connections of mine. But the good news is that, you know, I do seem to touch some people, and I've gotten remarks, you know, from Facebook. I've gotten remarks one-on-one that they were moved and touched, and, you know, I have heard a lot of very encouraging things. I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but about 3 years ago, I received the Courage of Conscience Award from the Peace Abbey.
Yes.
And I was... that was another kind of turning point for me, because I was very humbled by that.
Yeah, why don't you mention a little bit more about the award? And I mean, there's quite a number of recipients, all extremely impressive. Maybe you mentioned two or three that you would like to, that are also recipients as you have become.
Yeah, well, it's an award for humanitarian and peace activism. So a lot of the recipients go back from many... many well-known names like Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa and Muhammad Ali, but also they rescued a cow from a slaughterhouse at one point named Emily. And so this is, they also have a lot of attention on animal rights and animal consciousness. So Ingrid Newkirk from PETA has gotten the award, and I can't think right now who else, but... It was a great motivator for me. You know, I was very surprised, and but it kind of kicked things up for me in realizing that I really do have a gift here that can be used to help the situation with the animals, you know, by giving a voice to animals. So the award just gave it a gravitas that I had never really embraced before. So
pretty good company to keep, for sure. So congratulations. Yeah. That's great. Let's discuss art as animal advocacy a little bit. In what ways do you find it most effective?
Well, I just think there's a lot of ways up the mountain, and everybody's going to respond in a different way. So I would never presume to think that my artwork could affect or encourage or anything, everybody, or even a large majority. I just think that there's, you know, there's Sue Coe, who does this amazing work, very graphic about what goes on in factory farms and whatnot. And then my work's more, I'd say, you know, metaphorical, I guess, or humorous. And there's just so many different ways and different, that it's going to speak to different people, you know.
Yeah. Well, from your standpoint, how does it compare with other forms of animal advocacy?
I think there's something about, I'll speak for visual art because that's what I am, a visual artist. I think there's a way in which artwork can skip past people's fence system. So while I definitely think there's a place for every type of advocacy, and I really believe that, but I know for myself that when I have my defenses up, if someone's coming at me with clear facts, you know, whether I was a smoker or drinker or, you know, eating meat or whatever, that I just would dig my heels in. But it's through these, you know, through visual art, I think, is a way that sort of skips past defense systems. And before you know it, you're absorbing information and thoughts that you don't even realize. So I think that's how it works in my mind.
Yeah. It's sneaky in the best way possible, it sounds like.
Sneaky,
yeah. Yeah. So let's, this I think probably is the optimal time to get into a little bit more discussion of Beasts of Burden, which again is a exhibition that you've curated featuring 15 artists, yourself included. So what was the genesis of the exhibit?
I had the idea, I applied for the Curatorial Opportunity Program from the New Art Center in Newton, Mass., and I got it, which was great. And so, but as far as how I came up with the idea, I just was feeling kind of overwhelmed with all of the different aspects that animals are involved in our lives, that I try to incorporate all these different themes at once within my paintings, but I just got this idea that wouldn't it be great to have all different artists, each one focusing in their own way on animals. So that's where it first came.
Mm-hmm. And what was the, beyond just that, the overall parameters that you just described, what was your criteria for selecting the artists who are ultimately represented in Beasts of Burden?
Pretty unintellectual. I'd seen artwork that I loved, and I reached out to that artist, and in a lot of cases, they were very excited by the idea. And so, you know, just having been exposed to a lot of different artwork over the years, I had just come in contact with these different artists.
Now, one name that I think folks listening that may jump out a little bit differently for one reason or another is Moby. Now, what was your relationship with Moby prior to curating Beasts of Burden?
My relationship with Moby was based on loving his music.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I learned about his animal activism by going to see him playing, and he was playing footage of factory farming in the front lobby. But I also, through going to various art venues like Art Basel Miami, I started to see his photography, which I hadn't known about, and I just thought, oh man, that would be so perfect, because he deals with this sort of futuristic idea of post apocalyptic world where people are hiding in shame and they have these animal masks. And I just thought, you know, that's one aspect of animals that I hadn't really addressed at all. So I reached out and was able to get through, and he was interested.
That's great. Yeah, one thing it seems about Moby is generally fairly accessible, but one way or the other, once you get through to him, it seems like he's game to do a lot of things that comparable artists aren't necessarily as inclined to do.
Yeah, very excited.
So Beasts of Burden has shown so far in Boston and New York. Describe a little bit, if you could, the response to the show and maybe how those reactions have differed in each of those cities.
The Boston area one was 3 or 4 years ago. And it was a very, very big response as far as, you know, a turnout for the show and a lot of excited commentary from people. And I would say the same thing was true for New York. New York was a pop-up exhibition that I put on to be going on at the same time as the Compassion Arts and Culture and Animals Festival at Symphony Space, which I also was giving a presentation about Beasts of Burden at. So the pop-up exhibit was wonderful, but there is a downside to a pop-up exhibit, is that you don't have a track record, you don't have the momentum that was there for the first one with the New Art Center and the Unbound Project, which was the two groups that were supporting the Beasts of Burden number one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with animal advocate and artist Jane O'Hara, discussing at the moment Beasts of Burden, an exhibition featuring the work of O'Hara and 14 other artists. We're in the final few moments of our conversation, but we invite you to join that conversation if you'd like by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So one of our texters has a question that I was gearing up to ask a little bit later, but I'm going to ask it now. Will she, meaning you, Jane, be displaying any of her art in our area, meaning in the greater Tampa, St. Pete, etc. area?
I don't have plans to at the moment, but sounds good to me.
Okay. Perhaps on a related note, I was wondering what kind of plans there might be on the horizon for other shows, other locations for Beasts of Burden. And I don't know if there's any you can talk about, or if perhaps Florida might be on the itinerary at some point.
I am interested in Florida, and I'm going to be looking into venues and ideas. I started thinking about that recently. As I think you know, I was going to be having Beasts of Burden go to the Animal Museum in Los Angeles, but unfortunately the Animal Museum had to close down. But there is some talk of the Animal Museum opening again. I would love to show out there again if it does. Right now I'm in negotiations with a a great museum up in the New England area. So that would probably be 2019 if that happens.
All right. And so this would be a good time to mention that your website is janeohara.com to keep track of goings-ons, news, exhibits, other things that might be pending or newly announced. So, and let me come back a little bit to a question similar to what I asked earlier about your own work, but widen it out a little bit regarding Beeswax Burn. In what ways do you feel that those two cities, New York and Boston, where it has shown so far, do you get the sense that it has, you know, spurred further thought, affected change, had some impact in that way as an overall collective exhibit?
I'm sorry, once again, I'm missing the main point of your question.
My main point, I guess, is similar to asking you how your own work has affected people, if you've had conversations, online exchanges, et cetera. What sense you get to the reaction people have more broadly to the entire Beeswax Burn exhibition?
Well, one thing that's been very exciting to me is the different types of people and their reactions. You know, one thing I love about Beeswax Burn is that it just approaches people at all different ways. And so I get a huge range of reactions, some about the beauty of the artwork or the humor, but some are deeply moved by some of the messages. You know, one of the things that has I've incorporated into the both exhibits was Mercy for Animals, which is a charity group that, you know, focuses on protecting farm animals. They have done a series of short videos, and I screened this video called Animals Are Not Trash, and it shows very graphic imagery of chicks being ground up and whatever, all the different ways in which animals are so disposable in the agribusiness. And so, anyway, I have this video screened on Denise Lindquist's soft sculpture, which is a transformed iMac G4 of a lamb, and the whole thing is behind my screen Sacrifice. So all of this is just showing the schizophrenia of, you know, you have this terrible imagery, you know, showing through this cute, fluffy little lamb, and it's all behind Sacrifice, just which I think focuses the idea of how we are so able to have a blind eye towards what goes on behind closed doors.
Well, certainly that reminds me that one of the things that I thought was kind of striking and effective and may be something you're going to do in the future editions of the show was that, I guess it was the pop-up version, where in addition to the artwork itself, there was poetry reading, live music, some other elements. And I would think that in some ways that, again, probably widened out the impact and maybe helped communicate the messages in yet a different way than just the...
Well, yes. The organization Compassion Arts, which is a few years old, they have a Compassion Arts Festival, which was I had mentioned before. And, you know, their main goal is to use creative arts for cultivating compassion. And so years ago, I was asked to give a presentation of my artwork. So that was the first time I was using a different way of kind of getting... So I showed slides of my artwork, and then... And another event, which was our Earth Week or Earth Month at Pace University, was where I met Joy Eskew and Gretchen Primack. The three of us were giving a presentation there, Gretchen with her poetry and Joy with her beautiful music. So I had hoped to work with them again because we all just really felt excited by the kind of three-way approach. So when Compassion Arts joined with Culture and Animals Foundation for the festival this year in October, they had their festival at Symphony Space in New York City, and it was at the same time that I had the pop-up exhibit, not coincidentally.
Yeah.
I was so lucky to have both Gretchen and Joy join me in trying to you know, creatively approach the topics of animals.
For sure. So lastly, we just have maybe a minute or less at this point left, Jane, but as the, sounds like at least, the plans for Beeswax Burn are indeed for it to make it to more and more cities, and as it does make it to more cities and different kinds of settings, pop-up things, et cetera, what for you would a successful outcome look like for the exhibit?
Well, just more, I think. I just really look forward to getting it to different areas and, you know, exposing these great artists to a larger audience. What really excites me about the potential next museum is that it's reaching a different crowd. It's not preaching to the choir or to my personal base of friends and connections, but we'll reach a much broader, more mainstream audience of people that would go to a museum. And so that's very exciting to me because I feel that this exhibit can really touch people at all different, you know, levels and ways. So that and then the book that I did, Beast of Burden, Our Complex Relationship with Animals, is something that I got a grant for from the Culture and Animals Foundation. And that cataloged the show, and that also, you know, includes how the exhibit came to be, what it means to me. It features the artwork and thoughts of the artist. And so that's another way that I hope to spread, you know, the message.
For sure. Well, we'll keep an eye on JaneOHara.com and hope that at some point Beast of Burden does make its way to Florida. And again, I want to thank you for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals, Jane.
Well, thank you so much, Duncan.
Thank you. Bye-bye. In a few moments, I'll speak with Rowan Deacon, director of Nature, The Last Rhino, a new PBS documentary airing tonight about Sudan, the very last male northern white rhinoceros. It's a fascinating and at times quite poignant film. Right now, it's time to step into the comedy corner with a top fave of ours, Jim Gaffigan. I only realized last week that we have something new from him we haven't even played yet. So, from his new album, Cinco, this is Jim Gaffigan with a piece called Animal Lover in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
I do love steak, but it is rather barbaric, right? I mean, we're eating a part of a cow, and I love animals, and I love animal lovers. My favorite are the people that carry around the dog in a bag. Whenever I see that, I always think, what an adorable way to let us know you're crazy. Because they're crazy. They're carrying around an animal that can walk in a bag. They're not going to the vet, they're shopping. That's okay, but if I carry around a canned ham, I'm a weirdo. It'd be one thing if the dog looked happy, but the dog always has a look on his face like, can you believe I'm sitting in a purse? I was part of Mexican royalty. But I get it, I love dogs, and I think it's cute when people dress their dogs up, but how do you have your dog in a jacket and walk by a homeless person? Sorry, I'd help, but I spent all my money on a coat for my animal that's born with a coat. I love cats. Some people don't like cats. Our neighbor has a cat, and she lives in a studio apartment, or as I refer to it, a litter box. One time she asked me, she was like, can you even tell I have a cat? And I was like, no, but I can tell you have a box of turds in your apartment. I'm not sure if that's the same question. We all have the friend with the cat, right? In the small place, you visit them, the cat does their business. You don't really acknowledge it. You just go on with the conversation. What do you want on your pizza? Bleach. Febreze. Can we open a window or knock down a wall? Are my eyes bleeding? How about we throw a diaper on the kitty? But I get it, because I love animals. I think being around animals, there's a healing quality. But I also think we give animals too much credit. Like a dog is man's best friend. I've never seen a dog help someone move. Yes, horses are graceful and elegant until you see them poop standing up. Dolphins are smart. Learn English like Jesus did. For the record, I would never eat a dolphin because I don't like fish. And I know I'll get tweets where people will say, dolphins are mammals, and those are the people I block. Because that's how I deal with criticism.
That was Jim Gaffigan with a piece called Animal Lover, taken from his new album, Cinco. Okay, on to Rowan Deakin, director of an edition of Nature airing on PBS tonight called The Last Rhino. The title is definitely truth in advertising, as we'll hear momentarily. Speaking with us from the UK, this is Rowan Deakin on Talk Animals. Good morning, Rowan.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can, sorry. Thank you so much. As Rowan knows, we are having yet additional phone problems, as we do every day or week here at WMNF. And so she was kind enough on her own dime to call us from the UK. So I really appreciate it, Rowan. Thank you so much.
No problem.
So I loved the film. And as I mentioned a moment ago, I found it both fascinating and at times quite poignant. Tell us a little bit about Sudan.
Well, yeah, Sudan is a very old rhino. He's 43, which is old in rhino terms. They normally live to about 40. He lives in a large conservancy in Kenya. And he's the last male northern white rhino in the world. So he has a dubious status, which has also earned him the fame. He's visited by tourists and conservationists around the world, kind of eager to see this sad specimen. And he lives a very pampered life in Kenya because of his kind of status as the last. They're desperately trying to keep him and the two females that live alongside him alive. Because there's a plan to try and use IVF to keep the species alive, a sort of 11th hour attempt to save them from extinction.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. The film covers a great deal of ground from the feelings and observations of Sudan's full-time keeper, Zach, who I really became quite, felt quite attached to by the time the film was done. And obviously he's quite attached to Sudan.
Yeah.
And then, as you note, the film really widens out to address the heretofore maybe explored area of rhino IVF. And again, just as a measure of just how important it is to try to really extend that species and all the kinds of scientific and other efforts being made to do so. So as you note, though, Sudan is 43 and getting on in years. And, you know, there's something about him. How did you feel about Sudan? I mean, there's something about rhinos. I mean, I don't know if anyone would accuse them of being super cute or cuddly, but I found at least Sudan kind of gentle and sort of charismatic in his own way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about, I mean, Sudan is unusual. He's lived almost his entire life in captivity, so he is a very gentle rhino, despite the fact that he's enormous, and he's quite frightening to stand next to, because you are aware that he could, if he wanted to, kill you.
Yeah.
But he is very, very used to human beings. I think what I found most poignant about meeting Sudan is that they are rhinos. Yeah, they're not cute, but they are charismatic. There's something about them that's ancient, you know? They've lived on this earth for millions of years, far longer than humans, and they're so strong and big and impressive creatures that you can't quite believe that you're looking at the last one of a kind, because, you know, they both present themselves as these super strong animals, but also Sudan reveals their fragility, you know, because they're easy to hunt. They're very easy to hunt. They haven't got very good eyesight, and you can, you know, if you've got a gun, you can shoot a rhino. It's not hard.
Yeah.
So they've fallen, you know, because of the horn that's used in the Far East. They're strong, but they're fragile. And I think that's what Sudan, I think that's why people find him captivating, because he shows both those two sides to these creatures. And that's what's kind of sad about him, because he's harmless, you know?
Right.
They don't have prey. They eat grass.
Right. That's the thing. And yet, because of his status as the last one, last male at least, on Earth. During the day, again, we see this really kind, gentle soul, Zach, looking after all his needs and making sure his area is, you know, raked from rocks and just comfortable at all times. But at night, when it gets dark, there are armed guards protecting Sudan and the other females that are nearby as well. And so, again, it just underscores the importance of maintaining rhinos of any kind, but especially these last few of this particular species.
Yeah, no, that's what was particularly shocking, that there's these three left. I mean, there are other species of rhinos on the conservancy, which is why they're a target for poachers.
So
poachers will even, you know, there are no wild rhinos left. They have to live in conservancies. It's the only way. So so poachers will target the conservancy where Sudan lives. And because Sudan and the two females are quite used to humans coming up close to them, they wouldn't fright if a poacher came. So they have to be super protected. guarded by these armed guards. I mean, there's a 24-hour armed guard stationed near Sudan Boma. It's a little home that he lives in. And at night, they have to patrol around his enclosure because there have been attempts to poach him, not by people who want to poach him because he's the last rhino, but because he has, you know, a stump of a horn,
right?
And that's incredibly valuable if you're a poor Kenyan. So and while we were there filming, actually, there was an attempt made, a poaching attempt made, not on Sudan but on some of the other species of rhinos, and those poachers were a rhino was killed, a pregnant female rhino was killed, and those poachers were caught while we were there. So it's ongoing, even when these rhinos are in kind of protected areas.
The struggle is immense, and it just shows you what the stakes are for these poachers, I guess. So Rome, we have just about reached the end of our time, but again, the film is The Last Rhino. It's, again, part of the Nature series. It's airing tonight on PBS. Just check your local listings, as they say. And Rowan, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals and for your wonderful film.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We have just about reached the end of Talking Animals. Rob Laura is up next with Radioactivity, and then followed by Midpoint with Nola Lalay at noon. John Gilmore presides over executive session at 1 p.m. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Next week on Talking Animals, we'll have some humans and dogs from Canine Companions for Independence joining me in studio, no less. Bill Gregg and his dog Abner, and Mary Tyler Jacobs and the puppy she's currently raising, whose name I unfortunately forgot to write down. But that's also partly to call attention to Dog Fest Walk and Roll, which is coming up March 3rd at Al Lopez Park. So meanwhile, I invite you to join me at talkinganimals.net for audio archives, every show we've ever broadcast, iTunes podcasts are available there too, etc. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I'm Duncan Strauss. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. I was going to play the Bottle Rockets, but catch them tonight at Skipper's. It's WMNF Tampa.